All right, so it's 3:21, about 9 a.m. Thursday. This pod is with Zach Smith. He's the author of this book, Everything is Totally Fine. It's a short story collection. I was breaking it down in the pod. It's three sections called Everything is Totally Fucked, Everything is Totally Fine. And the last section is called Everything is Normal Life. And it's about 70, 69 short stories that are each like a page or a page and a half. The whole book is 147 pages, and they're really, I was laughing my ass off reading these. This book came out January 2022, same month as Fuckboy, put out by Moo Moo House, which is Tao Lin's press. And it was edited by the editor, Yuka Igarashi, who edited Soft Skull and edits Grey Wolf now. But it's honestly really funny, really, really excellent short stories with really surprising and funny turns in it. In general, I think I kind of botched what I was wanted to say. I feel like it's like it's dark, but it's like kind of this energy of there's like a certain fatalism to the stories, or like an acceptance of death, or acceptance of everything being totally fucked. But kind of with the, I was saying, accepting that everything's totally fucked with a shit-eating grin on your face. Kind of that energy, but maybe and some of these stories have an element of whenever you're doing absurdist work like that, it's kind of like what's the thing that keeps the feeling there and keeps it not totally sneering nihilism. And I think that, you know, Zach, we spoke yesterday at 9 a.m. because he got a couple kids, and he got more limited windows than me of when he can pod. I thought I could just read a short story. I don't think he'd mind. I think it'll make the listener understand the book a little better if I read a short story from him. That was my favorite one from the collection. Had me dying. Like usual, I didn't really make this clear on the pod last time, the intro last time, but the first like hour 20 is gonna be up, and then I just throw the last hour. We kind of went this last hour, which I don't listen back on, but I remember we're kind of rehashing some old stuff a little bit, and getting into some questions of indie versus big press stuff, which people feel strongly about. I don't think the divide is as great a divide as people want to make it out to be, but I understand how people feel that way sometimes. I'll just chop the video in half and the audio in half. So then, and it's not even me trying to hold out. It's just that I think the amount of people who are subscribed to that, to the Patreon, are getting up there, so I got to look out for them. But this story is called Imaginative Play, and it goes like this. I sent an email to the farm people to see if they had any openings on Tuesdays for the farm babies thing. You, like, let your kids play on the farm. The website thing mentions dirt a lot. It says it costs $8 for like an hour, which is pretty good compared to the other stuff, like the indoor play places with a bunch of toys or whatever, which cost $15. This one also probably involves animals, or like animals would be present within view of the farm babies activity stuff. Animal adjacent farm babies. You could see some chickens probably while playing in the dirt, which sounds pretty nice to me. I'd like that, at least. I was reading about farms and shit, like all this good stuff about them. Like in the dirt or whatever, there's all these different kinds of bacteria you don't get exposed to at parks or whatever. And the plants are good for you. The sunlight. I don't know, there's just all this stuff about them. Good for babies because of the stimulation, different kinds of stimulation, like the colors and movement or whatever.
it's like back to nature kind of stuff, but different, I guess, because the animals and the kinds of plants, like symbiotic, like agriculture stuff, old school human shit, grains and fungus or whatever. And $8 is a fucking steal too. Where else do you get to see goats and stuff? That's not a petting zoo. Cows. You can see cows probably. Man, imagine our baby touching a cow. No, but I mean, you probably can't touch the cows, but like, imagine. I haven't heard back from the farm people though, so it's probably a no-go. No farm babies, no chickens. I'm all excited for it, but it's not gonna happen. Like, I'm all pumped up, but it's probably not gonna happen. No cows, I guess. Fuck. Wait, hold on, I just got an email. Oh shit, nice.
That's imaginative play. Everything's totally fine. Zach Smith.
So yeah, I think that the fact that the narrator has kids kind of keeps the story, it kind of orients it emotionally a little bit in this way that's consistently surprising in the book, given the kind of tone of it otherwise. And yeah, just to say, like with this last hour, I don't mean to be hashing up, you know, old stuff, but it's kind of a significant time of year, I think. It's March 21, you know, 3 years ago in 2021. This whole stretch from March 1st to March, really the beginning of March, like right in the beginning of March, was a significant time. It was when my editor, Gian, had come out to New York, and I was editing a New York Tyrant website, a New York Tyrant magazine. And, you know, I was getting all these, there's a lot of momentum towards the book. The book was done. Fuckboy was done. And I was editing the site and getting a lot of emails and considering a lot of different stories to put up on the site. I put up a few sites, including the writer Sam Pink's story, poem, which I edited and we worked on it, called What's Your Favorite TV Show? And Kevin Bryce Gonzalez's story, Lindsay Lerman. And then in the end, I just put up this diary that my mom wrote. That was supposed to be after a long string of stories that I would put up there. But right around this time, like next week, I think I want to clear the docket a little bit, karmically or whatever. But next week was the week that, Gian ended up overdosing and my girl ended up passing away right before that. And then, it was kind of this weird energy at that time. And all the people who I kind of just dropped out of communication with, from working on their stories, kind of ended up being upset towards me because, you know, Gian dies and suddenly this big book deal comes out. But I think the reason I'm that glad I did this story was, like, I think people kind of thought that, like, I don't know, like the book completely changed when it went to Little Brown, but really, like, and yeah, I feel like the attacks I was getting were coming from so many different directions and I didn't even know what to address really. Because some of them were so more in a kind of cancel orientation versus any kind of legitimate critique. But and I've seen people say in reviews, like, oh yeah, the Gian version was probably like this, like the Little Brown version was like this. But the thing was, you know, when Gene Garnett, the editor at Little Brown, called me about picking up a book, that was literally my only stipulation, was that nothing could be removed from, or it couldn't be changed, it had to be Gian's version. So it really, and that was a thing they were really good about. I don't know, Zach was like all surprised when I said this. I thought it was clear, but the slight edits that Gene made were kind of streamlining things. There's like, yeah, one or two parts with the italicized sections late, the kind of more, and that was purely for the flow of it, versus anything, you know, for any, just this idea that, you know, once it gets in a big house, it's going to be, you know, all the crazy stuff will be taken out. But it really wasn't. The book that's out there was a book me and Gian edited. So I don't know. There's that. But ultimately, what's past is past. And I think this is just me trying to talk to everyone who I kind of wanted to have that energy of helping people out, and or just not helping people out, supporting people, supporting other artists. That's what we're supposed to be doing, supporting other artists. Not tearing the art down. And in order for me to get past, in order to be able to talk to Zach about it, we had to clear the docket on some stuff just because, you know, he reviewed my book on his blog, and he was always kind of, when there was like this mass energy towards me just from this community, you know, obviously there's many great reviews and many good positive readers of the book, which I'm grateful for, or just anyone who reads it really. But Zach had written this review on his blog that was kind of like, I don't know, I had to give him props because he's the only person who just like read the book and was just like, yeah, this, whatever attacks against this book from a craft, you know, from whatever, you know, questioning the legitimacy of the project due to its influences, that's kind of bullshit, you know. So even though he wasn't even that positive about every aspect of the book, the fact that he read it, I felt like I had to respect that, and that he wrote about it like that. So yeah, here's the convo. Clearing a docket, moving forward, everyone moving forward, I'm moving forward.
Don't get mad at us, nigga. Don't stop with all that hot shit, bro. Shut the fuck up.
We gonna beat your ass, bro. I'm trying to tell you.
I tell this bitch up, bro. Don't do that, dog. I tell this bitch up, nigga. It's still anything out this bitch. Fuck all this nigga.
We can start.
Sure. Good morning.
Hello. Yeah. Out here with Zach Smith, author of Everything's Totally Fine. I was thinking we could talk a little bit about the book and stuff, and then also nice to meet you. This is funny.
yeah, nice to be on a call with you, man.
Yeah.
How you doing?
You're trying to do the
is this early for
intro.
You?
You know, early, late. What's time?
It's
how about you? When'd you get up?
I got up a little before 6 today.
Damn.
Usually up around 6. Yeah. I mean, my kids are up a little early, so.
How old's your kid? Yeah.
I got 2. I got a 5 and a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Daughter and a son?
I try not to talk too much about stuff about them, but
fair,
there's 2 of them. They get along great, and it keeps up at night.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's nothing. Yeah, it's a lot of good parental stuff in your book, but I feel that.
Yeah, I read a lot of it when my oldest kid was like a toddler, so there's references to having a toddler.
Definitely.
Yeah. That's what time you usually get up? What's your schedule like?
My schedule when I'm on. Yeah, my schedule is it's all over the place, dude.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah,
you don't have kids, you can do whatever. That makes sense.
It's going till you drop and then start over.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, damn. I hadn't read the damn book, but I bodied the book and I.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah,
I was laughing. I was laughing my ass off, dude.
Thanks.
How crazy is? Yeah.
No, good.
How crazy is that? That they came out. Our books came out the same month.
I was thinking about that, right? Yeah, January 2022.
January 2022.
That's January is a rough month, I think, for like anything to come out. I was thinking about it in terms of like music. It's too late for obviously the year before, so no one's gonna write about your book for like end of year lists, and it's too early for the next year, so no one's gonna remember your book for the end of the year. Not that anyone's gonna write about my book for the end of the year list, but for even, you know, for a bigger book, I think January, December, those are rough months for a book to come out.
Yeah, maybe. No, I feel that. Is there some weird static going on, or am I only hearing that myself?
Might be. If you're hearing it though, it's probably recording. It's probably the shitty microphone.
What kind of mic you got? A Yeti?
No, it's a fine.
You got a Yeti gaming mic?
No.
Oh, shit, that looks pretty good.
It's supposed to be good, but then it like it's making it static.
Is you think that's your mic?
It might be. Should we
Should we check
the recording and then I'll
yeah, that's a good call. I'll check it and then but if I end it, I don't know if I can come back onto this one.
Okay. Here, let me just unplug it.
Okay, I'm gonna check it real quick. I'm gonna make a new one if it has to, if I have to. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. Is the static on?
Oh yeah, maybe we should just keep going like this.
Okay.
Do
Yeah,
you wanna?
fine. That works. Yeah, that's fine. I gotta get a new mic. This thing sucks.
Damn, damn, damn.
Sorry about
No, it's all good. But we were saying,
Yeah, so our books came out at the same time, which is a crazy time.
yeah. But I mean January, but that specific January. What
It
day did it
was.
come out? Do you remember?
Oh, that's a great question. We changed the date a couple times. It was going to come out, I think, in like November, but then there were that was back. Did this happen to you? Because this is back when like all the supply chain stuff was super fucked up, so like it was hard to get books printed. The printer like pushed it out by like a month or two. So I think it could have been worse, but yeah, it's supposed to come out late 2021, but I ended up getting my author copies in the mail like 2 days after my second kid was born, or like
Damn.
the day after.
Damn.
Yeah, so that was cool. And then the official date was January.
When did you finish writing it?
That's a good question. I was shopping it around in 2020, and I guess yeah, like 4 years ago now. So I don't remember anymore. But yeah, it was like I had versions of it probably mid to late 2020, and then like yeah, all the final edits were mid 2021. Like May 2021 is I think when we finished like the final draft of it.
Okay. And it was definitely kind of written over the pandemic.
I guess so. Yeah, I was working on it before, and then that's when I really like kicked into gear. Yeah, because everyone's at home, and I think I was thinking about that because someone else asked me about it. Because a lot of the like I was writing about, like I was synthesizing a lot of stuff that I was doing like during the middle of the lockdowns and stuff. Like any like so there's very little like interpersonal interaction. And lots of like outdoor stuff, where like, you're not really getting close to people, and so like it adds that like people felt like strangers, like wild animals. Like, oh shit, there's a person over there. I gotta stay away.
A lot
so
of
that was
just
a
like,
wild time.
yeah, like moving around the house, like losing your shit.
We were in a small apartment, and we had like a 1-year-old, 1.5-year-old.
Somewhere, where are you? Or yeah, you want to say the general, the
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
state
Yeah, I'm in Massachusetts. I'm in like Metro Boston. I'm in like a small town. I don't know if you call it the suburbs because they're like just small old towns around here, like kind of close to Concord, kind of close to Walden Pond, but like it's just like a smaller, it's not as rich as Concord. If you drive into Concord, it's like mansions all over the place, but it's just like little houses out here.
Got you.
But yeah, at the time we were in Somerville, which used to be like a rough town, but now it's like super gentrified. And we were there for a couple of years. Yeah.
Word. How old are you?
I'm 34.
34.
Yeah.
Damn, dude, we're on like damn
I know.
same schedule. That's crazy.
Yeah,
I was listening to the mic. I think I did listen to it when it came out. But I was listening to Michael Silverblatt one back, and it's crazy. Like it's like easy to access because he stopped posting, because
it's like
like
the
not long
what like
after.
almost second to last one he put up. Yeah, it's nuts.
And he like says some shit in the beginning where he's like, I mean, it's true. Like he's like, everyone wants to act like everything's totally fine, even though there's some shit going on that I can't even say on the air. I was like, damn, dude.
I mean, he was great to talk to. He's like a super cool guy. I hope he's doing all right. But yeah,
He's a goat, dude.
it was a weird time for him. Yeah, I mean, he's like incredible. I
I wish I could come through and just spit something I wrote down about your book and go right into it, but I can't. I can't. Well, I
that's
will. I
fine.
will. But
No. You do it anyway. No, he was cool to talk to. He was super nice. And yeah, I felt really lucky.
yeah. But
Yeah, it was kind of like, it was like weirdly emotional. It was emotional. It kind of made me like sad, like listening to that podcast. Yeah. It didn't make me sad, but it was like, he was like, there's like this literary community, this great literary community. I'm so glad he like reconnected to it. It was just you and Tao being like the spokesperson, people, and like just being so sweet and nice.
Yeah, because yeah, especially it was pretty tumultuous at the time.
Yeah.
It was just kind of sad. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was like an early champion to Tao too, you know, and he's always, he's helping people from way back. And yeah, I don't, it was, you know, yeah, this shit gets, yeah, people take weird stuff personally. But it felt good at the time to be like, I don't know, because there's not too much like small press representation in the bigger media. And so it felt like a big gamble for him to like, talk to us and talk about the book and sort of like legitimize it in a way that like I don't think happens as much anymore.
Yeah.
So that was cool. And I felt like, you know, as soon as we were done recording, I was like, oh man, I should have just like spent the whole time hyping up like all my friends' books and all these other small press books, you know, trying to like get the word out.
But you did a little bit. Yeah. No, it was interesting looking at. Yeah, so this book is yeah, damn. I remember when I was first seeing you on, do you remember? Yeah. I was trying to think of when I was first aware of you online.
Mm-hmm.
When do you think that was?
2018. I was starting to publish stuff, I think like 2018 online.
Yeah.
I started out just putting small stuff on websites and like magazines and just like a lot of people, you know, just like submitting stuff like wherever, you know, like getting excited about it.
Yeah.
And yeah, you had stuff in like X-Ray and
see, it was from that earlier era, yeah, like Soft Cartel and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah.
Because I remember people I remember from
early days of Back Patio.
Yeah, like exactly. Early days of Back Patio.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember you were like on a tear. I remember like you are not like I was there, but like I just remember like because you were in, so you had just finished some like PhD or something, was that right?
I dropped out or I you just stopped out. Doing it. Yeah, I
was you just dropped out and you started spazzing with the short absurd like funny and random stories.
I guess yeah I was doing grad school for linguistics and then I got I wasn't gonna finish it. And then I got a job, like an office job out here in Massachusetts. So I just like dipped. I'm like, okay, bye. And then just moved out here. And then just having that 9-to-5 back meant I could like read books again and feel good about reading fiction. And just like rediscovered a bunch of stuff. I used to like reading and read new stuff. I just grabbed stuff off these bookshelves and just had cool covers. I just read weird shit. And started writing. Like I tried writing. I think like anyone else, I tried writing like a novel. It sucked. And then I tried writing another one and it sucked. And then I started doing small stuff, you know, just like engaging online.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where it started popping off a little bit and like meeting people. And that's when Giacomo started Neutral Spaces. And so like people were blogging and like writing together in the stream. I was talking to Kevin and like, yeah, just like meeting people online, you know, just like whoever was around.
What were those novels like?
Stuff. Oh, they're bad, man.
You gonna resuscitate them?
No, I thought about it, but it's like, I think they were good to do to figure out what I didn't want to do or like think about sort of like what mindset I had going into them. But yeah, I don't think there's much like you could scrap from them. They're pretty, one is sort of like kind of like a body horror book. Which I definitely wouldn't want to publish, but like it was kind of inspired by this line, not line. You remember in, I think it was Knausgård's book 5, My Struggle Book 5. There's like an excerpt from his first novel that's not in English right now, all about like a burning building.
Okay.
Like him as a kid or some kid seeing this burning building. And I was like, that's tight. Okay. I want to write something like that.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was like towards the end. I don't. He had these like passages where he just like,
but not a time for everything.
Before no, not that. That one. That's the second one. Yeah, this one's called Out of the World.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. supposed to be translated this year, I think, on like Archipelago or Adelphi or something.
Okay.
Or maybe 2026. I don't know. They keep pushing it back because it's like 800 pages. It's
really big. Damn.
But no, I just remember that and think like, this is a cool scene. And like, I liked how it made me feel. And so I started riffing on this like a burning building scene and like these people like navigating it and like how stuff would burn up and all that stuff. And then so I wrote this like novel that sort of like ruminates on like death and like cremation and like medical stuff. But it had a lot of this, like stupid quirks to it that I wouldn't want to, and like thinking about it now are kind of embarrassing. So I kind of scrapped that and then wrote something else that was sort of inspired by Spurious by Lars Eyre, which in turn, like he takes a lot of influence from Thomas Bernhardt. So it was like two layers removed from Thomas Bernhardt. Not that good. Yeah. I thought it was funny at the time when I was writing it, and then I like reread it and like, this isn't funny. Like,
these aren't funny scenes. So Lars Eyre is someone who blurbed you.
Yeah. He's cool. I like him a lot. He's in UK.
Who is he?
He was a philosopher and then started writing novels. He started like, this is back, I don't know, like early, like mid 2000s, he was blogging. Okay. So he had this blog called the Spurious Blog, and he's writing, he's like riffing on these two philosophy professors.
Okay.
These two characters, and then turned into a book, and then turned that into a trilogy. And now he's doing another trilogy, like similarly about kids in school, like high school or college or grad school. But there's like a character who is basically modeled off after a famous philosopher, like Wittgenstein or Simone Weil and Nietzsche. So no, he's cool. So he like, I got Spurious because it was on Melville House and it came out around the time.
The book is called Spurious.
Yeah. Spurious, Dogma, and Exodus. And so they just follow these two guys. It's kind of riff. It's like full of like shit talk, and they're like, it resonated with me a lot because there's a lot of like talking shit about academia and like grad school and that stuff that was like really hit me right then at that time.
That's always good shit.
Yeah, so I tried ripping him off for a while, then I gave up on that.
I mean, that's kind of how you write. You read things and then write like them.
Yeah, no, it's normal. Yeah, and I think in that process, I mean, you gotta like, I was thinking about this, in the context of like reviews and stuff, like anything you read, I think, at least in my experience, like you should be reading, and this applies to music too, you should be like reading and listening critically, and even if you love the thing, like there's something you could think of that you would do differently, or you'd want to change, or be like, this is cool, but what if they did this?
And exactly.
That could be what you do, you know, like
You
make that change that you see that there's a potential gap or something new to explore. And and there's just like a good experience too, just like make yourself write a whole bunch of stuff and then just let it go and be like, okay, I got that out, and do something else now, and that helps you
figure out what you're doing. So you were reading Bernhard and Bernhard adjacent people and Nausgaard like before you wrote those early novel attempts, kind of before you were reading more outlet stuff, you'd say?
Or
alongside it.
I'm trying to think of like the timeline. Because I had read some Tao stuff way back, early 2010s.
Yeah.
But then I went off to school and like stopped reading fiction. Although I remember reading Taipei, like I got it for Christmas the year.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to use my Christmas break to read a book. And I loved it. I was over in Grand Rapids, Michigan, just like reading Taipei and like going record shopping and stuff. It was a great holiday. Then when I started reading again, my friend bought me Knausgaard and Struggle Book 1, and I just got some like random old classics and stuff. I remember early on, I remember The Power and the Glory, the Graham Greene, and just like stuff like that. I don't know, just old stuff. Because I'd read a bunch of like, I was a big reader in high school, so I read a bunch of like The Lost Generation stuff and Vonnegut. Stuff like that back in high school and college, and like David Foster Wallace in college, Dave Eggers, Hermann Hesse, Kafka, shit like that. So then I just read like mostly classics and stuff like you expect, and then Yeah, some alt-lit stuff, but mostly just Tao and like stuff online when it's coming yeah. out. And then, yeah. I took a break from all book stuff and then got back into it, started reading this, whatever. And then I remember thinking, like, these books from like these bookstores are good, but like, I wonder what Tao's up to.
Yeah, exactly. still writing.
Yeah, and then just finding people who are doing that kind of stuff. I remember finding Bud Smith, yeah, the Double Bird book.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, Sam Pink, you know, Cicero, and
like, yeah.
other people are just putting stuff out at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was like, I basically wrote like, that first novel without having read any of that. And then I read Spurious and I was reading Knausgård. And I remember like, I'm trying to remember the timeline of it. But yeah, I read Spurious and I was like, oh, this is great. And I was reading Knausgård and he mentions Bernhard. And I'm like, I should check this guy out. And then I read Frost, which is the first published Bernhard novel. And I was like, oh, this is what Lars read. This
type. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Did you yeah. read more Bernhard after that?
Yeah, for a while I tried to go in sequence. So I read Frost, Gargoyles, and what, like Concrete? And then I started skipping around. So I read a few of them.
You read like The Losers and Woodcutters and stuff?
No, I haven't read Woodcutters.
Oh,
that's the one everyone, I remember this one, like everyone in Alt-Lit would talk about too.
But dude, you know what Woodcutters is about?
Yeah, it's like a dude at a dinner party. He's like talking shit.
About, yeah, but do you know like, why he's at the dinner party?
No,
it's because it's a whole literary world that like they're all like used to be connected to years ago, but it's because a woman killed herself, and that's why they're all there for the party.
Oh shit! Yeah, so it's like a memorial kind of.
Exactly, and he hasn't seen these people in like 10 years, and he's just like these fucking assholes, like they're washed
artists. Yeah, yeah,
they fucking suck. Yeah, what is it about that, dude? Why is it so good? It's like the rant against something. I noticed that you know probably. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like, yeah, I would say like your aesthetic is like, yeah, like embracing, yeah, just kind of grinning your way towards a type of fatalism.
Yeah,
it's like yeah, facing yeah, death. Yeah, facing death with the grin.
I like that. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that a lot about Bernhard because he had a...
The coach story, I was going to say. The coach story was the most Bernharded.
Yeah, that's just me going, like, I'm just going to take, you know, like for fun. Like, what if I take a Thomas Bernhard character but make him a football coach in, like, 2018?
Yeah.
In, like, the Midwest.
Yeah.
And that's just, like, that's the joke. You know, that's the whole story. And
frame it in a damn, like a school interview
format. Yeah. Like what's the stupidest place I could put a Thomas Bernhard like insane monologue kind of guy,
or the literary agent story had some of that too, or it's just like
it's a fun like he's one of those dudes where if you just like I've riffed on a lot just for fun because like it's a compelling, I keep saying fun, I'm gonna say it again, it's a fun way to write. Like you just sit down and you're like, I'm just gonna rant. I'm gonna start italicizing words. I'm gonna start getting really repetitive. It rules. It's just like I don't know if you play any music, but it's like if you get like I play guitar a little bit. If you get like dial in some guitar tone, you start like playing a song. You know, you're like, yeah, it sounds just like the thing. And it's like, you know, you're just playing it, but it feels good. You know? It's like you're scratching that itch.
No, and I so, mean, yeah, that's all. Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, just all these. Well, it was interesting for me reading it, having kind of been in that mode of like, you know, what it is. It's just like techniques. Like I could see, I know all the stuff you've read or a lot of the stuff you've read,
right? Yeah, sure.
You know,
yeah,
so like I'm seeing the moves you're doing and how you're doing them, particularly in this, which is, yeah. So I was looking at it. It's like 147 pages, three parts, and like. 69 stories over 69 stories over 147 pages. So a lot of, just for people who haven't, you know, like
pages and math on them.
Yeah. So the pages are damn. I mean, the stories are just 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 pages. But especially when you're working on that short form and you're gonna put it online, and the different like moves you do to kind of like jolt the reader. I did this pod with this kid and I was trying to explain this point to him last week and he was like, wasn't getting it. He wasn't getting much of what I was saying. I don't really remember the pod that much, but I was like saying, you know, but it's like, anyway, it's just like the,
I was like identifying like all the alt lit, like, or like the Tao move, or like the whatever, the, you know, that kind of line broken move where you just kind of go, you kind of go like, you say something and then you go, or I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
Or you
yeah.
Go,
some like
post or, go, stuff. Or something. There you go. Seems good. But what it's doing is it's just jolting you out of the formality of like those moves just jolt you out of the formality of the tone that you think you're being led towards.
Right.
I really think it's a math. Yeah. This is like, honestly, I was laughing my ass off, dude. Because it's like, yeah, it's just like, but then it's like, but then what you do with those tools is like, yeah, like being able to create a sense of surprise in like a short period of time.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to do going into it. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like you could write in those modes where you're like, this is, I'm just like ripping someone off and it feels fun. But then also like, then you have to ask yourself like, what am I going to do to like subvert that or to
exactly
like twist on them? And like in like small stuff, like flash fiction online, especially, there's like this trope in like more self-serious writing, to be like, I'm writing a flash fiction piece. It's like 200 words long. And the last sentence I have, like, I reveal that I have a dead child and I'm sad
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, and that's the kind of shit that wins awards or whatever online. And I was right. so stupid. So I'm right. like, what if I take that formula, but then make the twist really stupid and just yeah. try to make it like the stupidest thing I can think of. Like,
yeah.
And that's where you introduce these postmodern things where you just like undercut yourself or you
exactly.
just like, do a non sequitur, or like address the reader, ask a question.
Address
like
the reader. Yep.
Yeah. And that's why I felt
bring
like,
them into the room. Yeah. Go second person in the last line.
Right. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
But even sometimes, hey. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I don't even know what I was gonna say.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying, like, yeah, and then you know, there's like the, and I wasn't pointing out those. I wasn't pointing out those like tools or like those moves, like, because once you have them, you, like what you do with them is what matters. You know what I mean?
I'm sure.
Like,
yeah.
You could just play. You could just do that all the time, and it wouldn't be good.
Yeah. I mean, you write what you read. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's but you're influenced by everything and you riff on it and like, but then yeah, I think everyone, no matter what's gonna introduce their own spin on it. But I think like at least for me writing that, I had this like goal going into it where I was like, I'm gonna start here, but then I'm gonna try to go somewhere completely different, in as many different ways as I can.
Exactly.
See like what that experience is like.
Yeah.
Find it better way.
Yeah, there's like the gravedigger story around the end.
Yeah, that one that's me riffing on Jan Fosse. I had read I read Trilogy way back and I was like,
okay.
How he does that dialogue
yeah.
where it's like it looks like dialogue, but it's just monologue, like the line break,
yeah.
it's the same person talking.
Exactly. Exactly.
That is such like a simple move.
Yeah.
But it creates this great effect because it
yeah.
makes you like read everything differently and picture your head differently. So early draft of that, I was just like, I'm going to follow this really strict conversational style where it's like, person says X, person said Y, and then build off of that.
Yeah.
And have that structure on it. And you get that repetition. You get that like mania.
Yeah. you're talking about the story.
He does that so well.
Yeah. You're talking about the story with like where they're picking out the plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. They're like at a cemetery.
At a cemetery.
And shit.
Yeah. And the damn the woman's trying to get like a really good plot, like a really deep plot, and then the husband's there and he's dead, but he's talking too. That reminded me. Yeah, it's interesting. And it was like where it was placed in the story. It also reminded me of like in How Should a Person Be at the End. It ends on this kind of like cryptic like parable, gravedigger scene. Or it reminded me of the part in Sabbath Theater when he's going to the gravedigger and picking his own grave. But that tone,
I haven't read either of those.
I had a feeling I was pretty sure you hadn't read Roth.
No, I haven't.
But just because, yeah, you're a minimalism, you'd have to fucking wade through all those rants. But I thought you might, but then you know what that tone reminded me of? It also reminded me of By Night in Chile. Have you read that book?
No, who's that book?
Oh, it's a Bologna. It's an early Bologna one. It's a really slim one. Oh, damn, damn. But it's like, you know, he's like, we need the best soil. We need like the best soil, like the deepest, you know, the strongest soil. And that book is all about the shoe. It, you would like that one. It's this rant by a shoemaker, and he's like the best shoemaker in the world. And he makes the shoes with the best leather and the strongest, the most durable fucking stitching. And then, of course, like, you know, and then some guy goes and he's on his deathbed and some guy goes and like fucks up his whole shit. He's like, no, dude, the water is going to get you. It's going to leak into your shoes, bro. He's like, no, I will find better leather. I will do better. Because that's what it is. Like you're pointing. Yeah. I think the Bernard stuff is comforting because it's like it's speaking. And the same thing that those moves are doing with Tao does a lot, where he'll often be like, he'll like whisper something or like not be heard.
Right.
Or yeah, like he'll be like, or something, or I don't even know. It's what it's doing is like I feel like it's conveying and inviting the reader into like a sense of like a intense alienation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like when Bernard's going like, yeah, I don't know.
No,
clown,
I think you're right.
Clown
I think
the literary right. agent. He thinks he's not gonna die.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they're different. Like. I think, yeah, they stand out to me. I think they resonate a lot of people because they're, yeah, I like your comparison of the Bernhard like ranting and then the Tao mumbling, which are like two different ways, to get to this alienation. And like, I think it's kind of ironic because they're both super common, I feel, day-to-day experiences you have with people in the world, but they don't show up in literature that much, you know? Like if you read something off the shelf in the new fiction, it's like every conversation is very clear, succinct. People say things perfectly, it flows really well, you know, people are speaking in paragraphs but they're not like sounding crazy. But if you take a step back and you're like, what would this actually look like in real life, you know, people are going to stutter, they're going to interrupt themselves, they're going to sound crazy. People are bringing all this baggage, they feel self-conscious, you know. And that's the that was like opening up for me, reading this kind of stuff and being like, yeah, you could write about that. And then how would I write that way? Or how would I write about that?
You think there are books like that, that like just a bunch of like well-adjusted people who like go through the world talking in sick paragraphs?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty common. There?
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the best books are about that, like alienation and like, I don't know. That seems like a quintessential of literature is like some kind of isolation, alienation, incommunicability. But I guess we're reading all, you know, the Norwegian folks and stuff. Are you frozen? God damn it. Sick. Got you back.
Yeah, I only just froze up. Sorry.
Okay, you're good. You're good.
Sorry. We were talking about like, I don't know. I feel like I've read some books where like they're heavy on, or they'll have passages of dialogue and it's just like, I don't know. It doesn't feel super realistic.
Yeah.
It just be like, you know, everyone's making the point really clearly. And there's no emphasis on how anyone's feeling during that moment or facial emotions. And all these are like little things that I think if you include them, it's probably easier to do in a really short piece. It jumps out and makes you recontextualize what these interactions are like.
Yeah.
Think about it. And that's why I like that Bernhard, where he'll just be like, yeah, basically it's people like ranting at you or ranting at each other. The Gargoyles is just like two pages of a guy going to see someone and then like 200 pages of that guy just rambling at him, you know?
right.
There he doesn't interact at all. Doesn't react. It's a different way to think about the story. You know, if you wrote that as a dialogue, would be a completely different book. I feel like I've read some stuff like, I don't know, the only thing I can think of right now is this Miyako Kawakami. She's a contemporary Japanese novelist.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, she wrote, I was reading something that I forget what it was called, Heaven maybe. And I just had this moment where it's like, these people are just like speaking in nice paragraphs to each other. And it's like, I don't know, it just didn't sit right with me.
Is that some Yuka edited or nah?
She did some, it's just a copy editing on it.
Okay, got you. Interesting.
She was cool. She sent or they sent a pic of, she was like, she, they printed out, she makes a copy of it, and then she got to the story with all the intentional typos.
Yeah,
it was like had too much blood drawn, start to pass out. She started, you could see like she's correcting them in the first like two sentences, like circling stuff, writing lots of question marks, and then she's like, "Oh, I get it," and then she stops. And she's like, "Okay,
wait for yours."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, you're talking about for there's a different Kawakami.
Okay, there's a different Kawakami.
Yeah.
Okay, but no.
Yeah, no, you're right. Because for Soft School, back when Yuko was editing there, they put out Hiromi Kawakami.
There you go. That's who I was thinking of. That's who I was thinking of. Okay, yeah.
People from my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a different Kawakami. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, I picked up one because I went to the like bookshelf in the library. I was like, oh, Kawakami, great. I grabbed it. It was the other one. Like,
got you. Yeah, so Yuka edited it.
Yeah, she put out a couple of the, I want to say it's for every Kawakami book, so it's Soft School. My thing is, I like it a little bit more. I want to read more about her. I think she did the Nakano thrift store, which is kind of bigger.
She did what?
What was it called? The Nakano thrift shop.
Okay.
Thrift store. I think that was a bigger book.
Yeah.
That was for every Kawakami. And then, Miyako did a book called Breast and Eggs and a couple other novels on Europa Editions, which is a publisher I don't know much about.
Yeah.
But she like won some prize for like the novella version of Breast and Eggs. And there's a great little Wikipedia article about it where like the judge is like, fucking hate this book. This is like a horrible story. I hate her writing style. She still won. It was really weird.
Damn. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I think that's just in the context of like, you know, dialogue or whatever, or what you choose to include or not include. I like the messier stuff. I think it's funnier. Subverting stuff from flash fiction.
How you feel? Yeah, I guess I want to thank you for reading the book and reviewing it too.
Of course, dude.
Kind of like speaking up against the mob. You're the only you're literally the only like not person who could bring up some shit, like just be like, nah, this is like, you gotta read the book. I mean, even amongst everybody, no one would touch it, dude.
I mean, that sucks. Yeah, no,
I gotta give you credit for that.
Sure, man. No, yeah, I like. I'm happy I read it. It's a good book. I like.
I feel like when shit was going down, dude, I feel like I'd see you being like, "Wait, hold up! Like, what happened here, though? Like, I don't really know what happened."
Yeah,
the only person, though. You're the only person.
No, I mean, I
like, because you actually read.
I don't read as much as I want, but
there's some connection. There's some connection.
You know, I think like, yeah, I think, you know, you read a lot. I think everyone should be reading a lot, especially if you're a writer. I think a lot of people do read a lot, but it's tough to prioritize what you read. And yeah, I think like, you know, it was going both ways. Like, Fuckboy's coming out, Sandpeak Essay came out, everyone decided like, I have to align myself in the right way because I'm afraid of whatever. Like, I don't want to, he had a lot of emotional language in the essay. And I think it was, I have a lot of personal feelings now about how I reacted and how I thought about things, and my relationship to all the people involved have changed. But like at the time, yeah, he was pitching it as like, this is small press indie stuff versus the big evil corporate publishing world and all this other stuff. And you know, I'm still very much pro indie lit small press stuff. I don't read a lot of big press fiction. When I do, I'm usually disappointed in it, or I find stuff predictable about it. Like, I just read that Diaries of an Oxygen Thief book.
Yeah,
it's like a bestseller or whatever. Fucking sucked. I hated that book.
Yeah, bro. I mean, that's why it's that's why you fucking support if somebody's fucking right. broke into the walls, dude. Exactly. Like, what are you talking about? And it's like, what emotional language, bro? It's like,
well, I mean,
I don't think
it was I don't want to get too deep into it.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying, like, it wasn't fear of like a line. It was mostly
personal attacks against you.
It was, yeah, it was full on personal attacks, bro.
But there's also like phrasing of, you know, it's personal because, you know, he has like this call to arms. Like, if you believe in small press, indie stuff, whatever.
Yeah, well, then why the fuck did he remove his book from Softcore and try to submit to Little Brown, dude?
That's like, it's
I'm just saying, dude. I'm just saying.
No, I
know. I don't think that's what happened. I don't think it was like aligning yourself. I think it was full on. It was full on like just like the worst, lowest form of like mob mentality. I feel like, sure. I don't know.
Well, I don't want to get too deep into it. What I want to say is it was mostly a personal attack against you, but it was mostly a personal attack against you, but there was also a lot of language in it to say like, you should draw the line in terms of like, cause he obviously wasn't going to talk about, you know, what he was doing behind the scenes and him trying to get a better book deal and stuff. And he's also a person who has a better book deal or had better book deals than 99% of the other people, you know, in the scene talking about. He was getting advances for books. He was on Softcore, all this stuff. You know, he was positioned better than like any of the indie lit kids.
Yeah.
You know. But all we had
the $3,000 contract that I signed with
you. But this is all stuff that no one knew, right? All people were going on was in SSA. And my point is that he had this thing.
Okay, go ahead.
At the time, that's all people had to go on. And that's all people had to make a decision about. And in terms of like reading the book or not, a lot of people took that to mean, I'm not going to read the book, I'm going to talk shit about it. And some other people took that to mean, I'm not going to read the book, but I'm going to praise it. And I'm going to be...
But I'm going
to
what?
But I'm still going to praise it and hype it up and just like, be like contrarian who? To the contrary. Just like random people.
I didn't see any of those. You're saying, oh, some people just, I'm not going to read it and I'm going to praise. You're talking about like one person?
I don't know. Maybe there's probably more. But also, if you look at Goodreads, a lot of people did read it. A lot of people had legit reactions.
Of course. I mean, it was.
You know, Goodreads algorithm puts the most liked thing at the top. You can filter and you're getting a trickle of reviews. Everyone's getting a trickle of reviews. But this is all to say, like, at the time, it felt like you had to make a lot of these decisions about alignment. And yeah, some people were using this to discuss like a larger political point. And I'm going to be honest, like, you know, I felt like that was a tactic that worked well in terms of manipulating how people thought about stuff, because, you know, I'm someone, I don't listen to like pop music. I don't listen to music on big labels. I like indie music. I like not knowing anything about the musicians who are putting out this music. And the same thing applies to books. It applies to art, you know, and a lot of people feel the same way. And so this is all just to point back on, like, in general, I think a lot of people in the indie scene are there because they have, you know, like a general disagreement with what kind of stuff gets on the big presses. Not that there's no exceptions. Obviously there are. I think Fuckboy is a great example of an exception. But I'm sure, you know, in general, if I pick something off the new fiction shelf, like, I kind of know going into it what to expect. It's probably going to be too long. It's probably going to have some twists at the end. It's probably going to have some more like political or cultural commentary kind of stuff. It's not going to take certain kinds of formal
reasons. Just listen, let me just say something real quick.
Well, I'm not talking about Fuckboy in general. I'm just talking about
general. I know, but you understand that was Gion's project, right? Like, I think it's like a convenient blindness. Like, you understand that was Gion's project and it came out 9 months as is on a different press, right?
Sure, that's good. I mean, people didn't
know.
You
think
that
you should have any fidelity to, like, I think if anything, you're talking about some kind of authenticity of being indie and not liking things that are mainstream. Every single person who wanted to be approved by Gion so bad, and then when you completely trash his last project, immediately that exposes you as not actually caring about what Gion likes. You don't actually care about the things that Gion cared about what's important in art. You were literally just scheming to try to climb up to get Gion. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I think it's a little hypocritical, dude. I think, you know, it's like, you don't need to, Zach, you don't need to tell me about fucking mainstream books or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
No, I know. And again, like,
I went through a whole MFA program only listening to Gion.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, but no one had read the book, right? It wasn't out. No one knew what it was going to look like.
What was that?
No one had read the book at the time. Again,
right.
We gotta move past this stuff, man.
I know. I'm moving past it. Dude. I'm moving past it. It's just like it's real though, dude. It affects. I don't know. It affects.
Sure. It sucks for you. It sucks for a lot of people. It's a chaotic time.
No, it affects. We gotta move on. It affects people. Yeah.
You know, I think yeah. When John died and Tao put up all the write ups on Moonwood House, all the eulogies and stuff, and then ever since then, you see like a million people coming out of the woodwork. Like, yeah, he told me he was gonna publish my book too. Blah blah blah. People are putting quotes from him in their books and using correspondence from him as a blurb. Like, yeah, of course. And a lot of people are talking shit about him because he rejected them. And I think it's pretty transparent. But bro, yeah. Again, I just wanted to focus on the idea of like reading books, talking about books.
Me too. I literally only all I wanted to say was that I appreciated you doing just that, reading the book and talking about the books and
the reason people.
That's literally all.
I guess my point was, yeah, of course.
But it is different. Uncommon. It is. It does matter how you move. Like you moved with Kurt. I don't know. It's like you should be able to move with. I don't know. That matters. Like courage matters. I feel like.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, and I think it's. You know, I like reading books. I like writing about books. I can't really stop myself from wanting to write even a short review on whatever I read. But that comes at a personal and political and social cost. You know, like. This is people's art, and obviously, you know, that's like you're sensitive about how people respond to it. And if you feel like I've alienated a lot of people writing about their books, and that's tough because a lot of them are people in the small indie publishing scene. You know, they're only selling 20 books, they're only selling 100 books, and they're not getting any reviews. They have like 5 Goodreads reviews, and then they got like this motherfucker coming on this blog writing like a pan.
Yeah, you're a snarky fuck, dude. I see how you review books. that's your shit. Like, I understand your sensibility. I understand your orientation towards the world a little bit better for reading your book. And
but I think it's a disservice to any writer to just say, oh, my friend wrote this book, it's a 5-star book, or my enemy wrote this book, it's a 1-star book.
I don't think it's ever a disservice to anyone just say it's a 5-star book. I only take in art that I like, I feel like. But I hear what you're saying.
And this is back to the thing of like what you're reading. Like you should be thinking critically, even if you really love it, you should be thinking critically about it. I think so. Yeah.
You should be thinking critically about it. Yeah. You should be taking what you like.
I mean, you should be thinking critically about it. You should be open to yourself about what you're experiencing when you read it, how it's making you feel, what you think you would do differently, like what stands out to you at the not just like the subject or like the flow or whatever, but the word choice, the constructions, like are there a lot of cliches in this, like is there a lot of redundancy, would I have edited this differently, would I have sequenced this differently, like for story collections or poetry collections, like that kind of stuff sticks out to me. But I think like, so I can't help myself but read anything with that eye, and then I want to write it down what I experienced doing that. Yeah, even books I love, you know, there's stuff that I maybe like stupid me to say, but things I would do differently, or things don't sit right with me, or things I'd be curious about what would happen if you did it a different way. And so that I try to like think that in the review, right? Like what stood out to me is something unique, what's something I liked, what's something I didn't like, what would I have done differently? I think a lot of my reviews are like, I would be interested in this portion being its own book, or I'd be interested in resequencing it this way or editing it differently, because that's just how I approach
stuff.
But that doesn't sit well with a lot of people and they'll, you know, freak out. So if you're someone who's like, I want to read books and talk about books and write about books, but I'm worried about the social impact of being openly critical or negative or calling something out on some bullshit it's doing, you're gonna have to pay a social price to that. You're gonna get blocked by people, you're gonna lose friends over it.
You've had shit like that happen?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I had people talking shit about me. I wrote this middling review of this book. I thought it was fine, but it wasn't great. I thought it did a lot of stuff that was dumb. And somehow they found it and started talking shit about me on Twitter and posted my headshot. And they're like, look at this dumb motherfucker. Look at this ugly idiot. And then I laughed because that this person, it was like the picture of me, I had like my eyes closed, my mouth open, short hair and a beard, white dude. And this person had almost an identical author photo, fucking same headshot, eyes closed, mouth open, facial hair. And I'm like, you look the same. You can't make fun of me for that shit. But, you know, and then, you know, stirring up a whole bunch of shit, like, yeah, you get blocked by people, you get, you know, soft blocked by people over it. And it just comes
with what that means. What does that mean, soft blocked?
It's where you block someone very briefly and then unblock them. Oh. So that if you're following them or they're following you, it removes that mutual
connection. I see.
So I think a lot of people won't write, you know, like honest reviews, especially in small press stuff. And I understand that fear. But it is from a place of fear, you know.
So. No, I guess reviews are good. I think cancel attempts are different, but
it is, bro.
But damn, dude, there's so many funny ass stories in here. But how's your Septology reading group? You doing that?
Yeah, it's going well. I think I'm actually the furthest behind.
You still doing it?
Yeah. It became my nighttime book that I read just before bed. So I read like 3 pages a day.
Do you not want to talk about anything in your personal life?
No, it's fine. Yeah. I was just curious, I can talk about
started doing mailman stuff and how that's going.
I'm not going to be doing the
post office. Bet.
Yeah, it ended up being different in a lot of ways than I anticipated.
You went in for a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, I did some training. I did some the shadowing. I was riding around in the truck.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. The guy trained me. It was pretty dope. It was fun. It's like the pay was a lot less than I thought it was going to be. The benefits don't kick in until like your first 2 years.
Yeah.
You're on a pretty long probationary period. Scheduling's pretty rough. The hours are pretty rough. You come in lowest on the totem pole. You have the shittiest shifts. And you have to work like 6 days a week. Compulsory overtime kind of stuff. And, wasn't going to leave me any options to like do anything else. back on the hunt. But it was a trip. It was crazy.
Yeah. Damn.
So that's what it is. And you asked about the Septology book club. That was fun. That's just like a low key group chat with like 15 people in it.
Okay.
A couple people already finished the book. I'm super slow, but we just talk about stuff as it comes up and kind of riff on it. It's a funny book. I mean, it's a sad, intense book, but it's a pretty funny book.
Yeah.
So that's been fun. I wish I was in a position to just like sit down and rail it for a week like you did. That's really cool. I used to be able to do that, but I can't.
You got real, real responsibilities.
Yeah. And I've been like reading other stuff like throughout the day, like in the snatches and free time and stuff. So I'm going extra slow. It's like a huge book, right? So I'm not gonna, like, I have the hardcover too. So I'm not gonna like carry it around.
Yeah, exactly.
And read like, it's not a book you can read like 2 paragraphs of and put it back down. It's like,
it's
snappy.
for sure. No, I don't know what's better to have kids. Yeah. I don't know. Has your practice changed a lot since having kids, obviously?
Yeah, no, it's a big change. Yeah, especially going from 1 to 2, too. Because I wrote 50 barn poems when my first kid was pretty small.
Yeah.
And I wrote Everything Is Totally Fine before the second kid was born. So I was still pretty productive, but then with 2 of them and work stuff, like, my job changed a lot. Like negative ways, and I was pretty down on it for a while. So, and then I lost it. So I'm like not in space to. Haven't really been in space to write too much. Past like a year, but I'm trying to get back into it a little bit.
Yeah.
And I wasn't reading as much, you know, or I'd be like on the train, and I'd be like, there's no like Wi-Fi connection on it, so I'd read like a book in a day.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Going both ways, and then nothing else.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been kind of a tumultuous. Let's just hear for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, that's real.
But I'm fine. We're fine.
Yeah, it's just... totally fine. Everything's totally
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, everything is totally fine. Exactly. Now I catch myself saying that now. I'm like, I should probably stop saying that.
Nah, man.
Connotation now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nah, it seemed like. Yeah, fuck, dude. No, this shit made me start wanting to be excited about writing funny, making myself laugh writing again.
Yeah, good. I think you should.
I think my favorite story is.
I mean, there's a lot of funny shit in Fuckboy too. So like, you're not too far off.
You know? I was laughing. That's what I'm saying. Going back to that mode, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's part of like. I don't know if I could do a novel because I don't know how I would write it in a way that would satisfy me, like for a whole novel, you know, like anytime I try to write something longer form, it ends up getting overly dramatic. And like, I keep finding myself thinking in terms of these like structural tropes and cliches and stuff. And I'm like, how do you write a novel without twists and reveals and all this stuff? How do you keep like the humor up? How do you keep this alienation up? And it's like not impossible, but I don't know if I could do it. I don't know how I would do it. So that's why I just got stuck in this mode, you know, because it allowed me to do what I was wanting to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe it's got to go beyond humor and alienation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, cause like a novel sort of needs a plot. I mean, it doesn't need to, but that's the general conception of a novel. Like, is it even satisfying to write something where nothing happens for 200 pages or like in my stories, like I can condense a lot of plot in a really small space. So like, I feel like my book would have to span like 300 years, you know, if I try to write in that mode, but for a full novel.
Yeah. No, you do that well, where you encase like, there's like one story that was reminding me a little bit of the beginning of like Shoplifting. All the pizza stuff reminds me of what happened to the beginning of Shoplifting. I wanted to look it up, but I think I had like the PDF I bought on Moomoo.
Okay.
And he's like working at a pizza place or something, and he's like being kooky and fucking, but he's like young Tao, so he's like a real menacing and like fucking scary. Just like real psychopath hours. But
yeah, I haven't read that in a while. I picked it up a couple of years back.
Oh yeah, he's like, you're fired. And he's like, I forget. I think he quits his job or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's very like, don't give a fuck hours. Just
yeah, exactly. Don't give a fuck hours. Off.
Yeah,
you have a couple. Stories.
Yeah, go
you encase stuff. You encase the whole story in like nothing happens in the real time, but you encase it like something starts to happen. And you go, and then I thought all this goes two pages, and then like. It comes back the same, like nothing happens. I feel like you could do that over or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of what, not to compare myself to a Nobel Prize winning novelist, Jan Fosse does. But that's what he does. That's what all psychology is, right?
Bernard does. Yeah. That's what,
Because that's like a real thing.
Yeah. Matthias Enard?
Whatever. But,
yeah, he's a good ass friend. Multiple of them, almost no real time passes, and everything is memories.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's a cool effect. And because I was thinking about this in the Fosse book club, because it's like a real experience, especially like driving, right? Like you spend so much time in the car and it's like, daydreaming, remembering stuff, and remembering the same things over and over again, or thinking the same thoughts over again, like the same phrasing over again. That's such a realistic depiction that I feel is pretty uncommon. And so, yeah, I like that. And then in writing my stuff, I'm like, you know, you could be in line at the grocery store, and you just like, in the 30 seconds there, you think over like, I don't know, just like the craziest experiences of your life just pop into your head.
Exactly. Randomly, that's how your novel would be. It'd be like you walking to the grocery store and like getting like some shit for your house and coming home. And like along the way, you'd have like that's how your novel would be. But one story was, because we were messaging about how absurdly literal Fosse can be sometimes. Like I was hungry and I went to the food and drink place. And, like I ordered like, and he's all stoked off the fucking
open face ground beef, like burger. Yeah. I mean, yeah, a sandwich. Yeah. He's like, yeah, this is like such a good sandwich. And but
yeah. Just always, one... yeah, frying up those eggs and stuff. Just,
oh, yeah, exactly.
This tastes real fucking good, man.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. but you know, and then like Shining. The Shining, he's just like, I'm driving in the woods, and then like I start walking, and then I park, but then it's getting, you know, did you read that one?
The Shining novel?
Yeah.
No.
Or it's called A Shining.
Oh, no. Oh, this is a Fosse? No, I've
read it. Yeah, it's a really short Fosse. It's like, it's like a long story kind of, and it's sort of like, he's just like, I'm driving on a road and it's getting darker, and then I turn, and then I should go back now, it's getting dark, and then he like, and then he gets snowed in and he starts walking through the woods. And then like, he sees like his parents and he's not sure if it's parents. And then he sees like a bright light and then the book's over. But it was reminding me of your one story where you were like, bro, oh my God, dude. Yeah. It's one story. You're like driving and then like the fucking divider is getting narrower and narrower. Yeah. there's something like absurd and fossied out about that.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I should read that one. Yeah. I like him a lot. Yeah,
it's all right. It's all right. The Septology is the one that slaps for sure. but damn.
Well, I appreciate you reading it. Thank you, man.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, I was gonna. No, it's good to just talk. I was gonna read
something. Yeah. Just chat about whatever. The French authors you mentioned are a big blind spot for me. I've only read a couple of things.
Yeah.
France,
yeah,
because you're on that Welbeck stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've been, you know, I spoke to Dean about the Welbeck stuff, but I've read all of them, but Enard's like kind of, yeah, it's interesting when like you do different tech, when people do kind of similar techniques. I mean, Enard's way more like expansive and like kind of modernist maybe, whereas Welbeck's like, but they kind of have like a similar, whatever, like sensibilities in some ways, but then like they're almost like the orientation towards the world or like the political implications are like different.
Okay.
And I was noticing that too, where some like in some ways we're doing similar techniques or whatever, but and I feel like you have more feeling than some absurdist techniques you do. You know, mm-hmm. like I'm doing this, and then like I see someone's like head explode, and like, nah, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, happen, yeah,
right.
No, yeah.
You have more feeling than that, but then like you also have to insist on like, ending on an absurdist note, which is it's sick. I mean, I feel like you kind of are an absurdist, but like you're like unwilling to fully commit to some of the more.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, because I feel like. Yeah, anytime you pick a term or like a school of thought, right, like absurdism or whatever,
right,
people are like, yeah, a bunch of random shit happens for no reason, and that's the joke. But then, like, that's not super, I didn't consider that super fulfilling, right? I didn't want to write, like, a book where nothing, like, there's no state still, like, where nothing happens or whatever, or anything that happens doesn't matter. I didn't want anything to feel, like, interchangeable.
Yeah.
Unless it's like that's the point of it. So yeah, I wanted to ground everything as much like it's absurd, but it should have this logic to it, even if it's not like normal logic. Because I mean, I haven't read a whole bunch of like super absurdist stuff, but you know, there's like that vibe you get like, oh, this is a play where like people walk on and say like a random word and then walk off. And like, that's the absurd kind of humor of it, or that's the commentary of it.
Right.
I didn't want to like replicate that, but which is tough because then absurd is still like the right term for a lot of it, but it doesn't have, at least I didn't want it to have that connotation in how I approach it.
I feel like, you know, Doug, yeah, I feel like the fact that you're, you know, when the narrator's talking about kids and stuff, I feel like it's hard to be a complete absurd, nihilist absurdist if you got kids.
Yeah,
those are all the terms in the book. I feel like, you know, that like, I don't know, that one story you're talking about making a casserole and bringing the casserole to the house or whatever, or I don't know. And then at the end, he's like, he imagines how many guns he could hold in his hands, and it's like a joke, but then it's also like, I don't know. It's like protecting his kids, kind of, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think heaven. Yeah, I feel like something that I was thinking about a lot, and I still think about some stuff other people are writing, is like, how do you live in the world knowing what you know, or like feeling what you feel? You know, like we live in like a post-nihilism world, right? Like, you could conceive of a time before people like before the nihilism movement, like before the school of thought was like articulated and then like taught and spread, right? Like, but now we're in this post-nihilism world. So like we've already acknowledged, like, maybe everything is meaningless. And it's meaningless if you can't even make your own meaning. Like we're post-existential, post-nihilist, post-absurd, post-postmodern, but we're still doing it. we're still having kids, and we're still making casseroles, and we're still, you know, like driving around and picking up pizza. And so it's just funny to me, like we have this, the history of human knowledge and philosophy, and political thought, and all these things have happened in the world, and yet we're still just doing super mundane stuff, you know, like, yeah, just like this thought of like, you're a kid, you're like an angsty kid, and you're thinking like, oh, this is all meaningless, I'm gonna do whatever I want. And you're like rebelling against a dad who has like a PhD in philosophy. He's like, yeah, I know. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, like, this isn't you. That's funny to me, right? Like, we have this, like, we know about all these horrors and terror and like horrible things in the world and these crazy schools of thought. And yet we're still just doing it in normal day to day life. And so that's kind of what I was like thinking about a lot in the book. Yeah, you could just like have these really intense, intrusive thoughts that are like so much bigger than yourself, but it's still, you're still doing normal life. And it's like happening to everybody all the time, you know? So like you can't really even revel in it that much. You can't like celebrate it. Like post absurdity.
Yeah. Yeah. Post absurdity.
I don't think I did a good job of, like explaining myself that
well. You totally are. I'm. You think like, why? Yeah. Why do you keep doing it? You think it's because you had your first kid in 2019, so before the pandemic.
2018. Yeah, my kid was like 1.5 when it all went down.
Okay. Yeah. You think having kids is one, or what? Where are we now?
What do you mean?
Post absurdity.
Yeah, I mean, we're post everything. I don't know. Like, it's all on the table.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, we talked about this on the DM a little bit, but I guess, like, what I was trying to do with these stories and what I'm trying to do with the stories I'm writing now still is, like, we talked about with Bernhard and Fosse, where you just sort of write the same story over and over again. And, And Septology is talking about all of his paintings are the same painting, you know, where it's, like, trying to articulate something that you can't just state plainly. And I think that's a reasonable approach to writing, because it's like this, just this sense in my head. It's like a mix of a physical and emotional like stimulus in my brain. And writing stories a certain way is the best means I have of like capturing that feeling or expressing it a little bit. But none of them are perfect. None of them really get it. Or maybe it's like an accumulation of all of them. You get closer to it.
Yeah.
And so you have to, I think like a lot of writing is trying to, like make a painting of, trying to make a replication of this super abstract pit in you somewhere. And anytime you try to talk about it, you can't really express it. And like in Septology, it's always funny to me because it's like, trying to talk about his own paintings. He's like, it's like a painting of a boat. It's called The Silent Boat. It's like a boat, but it's like in the sky. But I like painted over it with black a lot.
He always like, says that he paints over it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like, you can tell like he's really trying to express something, but he can't talk about it and he can't even think about it in a clear way. All he can do is make a painting. And I think Fosse is using that as an allegory for his writing, right? He's writing the same scenes and the same kind of characters throughout his books and the same experiences, because he's trying to articulate this pit in his stomach or this like, hole in his brain.
Yeah, we were talking about about how in Septology, all of Fosse's books that he's written before are kind of folded into this big story. And then, you know, like all the early memories of the events, those were a whole book on its own before. So it's kind of like he's just trying to write the same core stories over and over again. I had this idea that so it sounds like you believe in writing a little bit still, maybe.
I want to. I think about it a lot. I've been writing a little bit more, but I also don't have like an articulable project that it's like working towards. So I just like the past couple of weeks, I just sent some stuff out for like websites, and stuff, just to like get the wheels turning again. You start asking myself those questions again, like, what about this isn't doing what I wanted to do? And challenge myself to come up with new turns to take or whatever.
One idea that's kind of relevant I had to that was like, because some of your stories are, they almost feel like parables sort of. One idea I had was like, well, and again, like, you know, there's, I feel like this book was also cathartic for me to read, because I feel like in a lot of ways, I mean, you're telling me to let go, you know, let go of this old shit. And the truth is, like, you know, that year was so fucked up for me, like that pandemic year was so fucked up. And I know everything that happened, including the stuff we're talking about, it just can't not be connected to the state that people were in and whatever weird psychic rifts were happening in the world at the time, and probably differently for everybody, which makes it even gnarly. Like, I'll talk to people like, oh, I went to fucking Italy for the whole pandemic. I was partying. It's like, oh, cool for you. But that's still a random ass thing to be doing. Like, you know, like, sick for you. But like, you know, and then I just look around and I see people like, I'm like Dan Bernard at the party when I see how people are just like, oh, whatever, like fucking, you know, I'm still trying to understand what that historical event was. And I think it is some kind of loss. Like, you had that great story. So it was cathartic because you were like prodding at some of the absurdities of that time. Whether I was bringing that's you painted the canvas that allowed me to sort through some of them.
For sure.
Going to vote, and then like you're on the screen, and like the screen's not working, and then the actual president comes, you know, like whatever. It's like, it's, and it's not even simple what you're saying, like politically, but it's just like, it was just like the weird shit that was going on.
I mean, yeah, there's a reason I was like, there's like what, like five stories about presidents and stuff. Like
five stories of president, the Barack Obama story.
Or
even just like everything to celebrate that everything is fucked, we're gonna just start burning things down. You start listing all the things that you burned down with the parentheses. I haven't seen the parentheses move where you do little comments in parentheses. That shit was funny as hell.
Thanks. But it was definitely like it's a product of the time, right? Like at the time, like the whole world's fucking falling apart. You
know? But I was thinking, like, that's one thing that got broken down was like some kind of, I don't even know, like sense of some bigger, it's like more and more bigger structures that, whether subconsciously or not, give us some sense of belonging or senses of continuity over time. And I feel like what we're searching for is like, or like I've been thinking about the idea of like the eternal, like, is anything eternal anymore? Like that you can be a part of, like, you know, it was like God, it was many different things in the past. And then even like something about just some baseline. Yeah. Something got broken in that time, I feel like, but I had this idea of like, and I was saying some of your stories were like parables. Like I had this idea and talking about retelling stories, like Harold was reading this Guy Davenport book and he was saying that, who's like a critic, and he got some, I haven't read him yet, but he was talking about like the reason why he's like, stories are most powerful, like not even in a critical argument, but they just are internally most powerful when they hearken back to the archaic, or like when they have like a mythical quality where they're retelling an old story, like respecting the archaic stories. And then it's not even like a argument about art. It's basically saying like the fact that these stories have been around for so long, and then you're partaking in the continuation of them being told, is itself continuing some eternal thing.
Okay. And that cycles back to like you're thinking of the eternal, like the art form of telling a story, like is that connection, or could be that connection.
Right. Or telling a story over and over again in your own life, everyone telling the same. And I was curious about what, because, you know, I was saying a lot of your stories do have this like self-contained. I mean, some of them are more riffs, but some of them do have that kind of quality a little bit.
And I was curious about how much you thought about like myths or like retelling. Or I feel like question. That would slap if you started going in. Like, I'm kind of doing that too a little bit, where I'm looking at certain books and like, you know, books from the Bible or just all kinds of shit. Or, you know, it's that Auerbach book too, which is really good, which kind of gets you charged up to read, like understand what those stories meant in that time.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it in terms of that, but that's a good.
Yeah,
I should think more on that. That wasn't something off the top of my head. Going in on it, but did you read A Time for Everything by Knausgård?
I never read it.
Okay, because that's exactly.
Retelling the Bible.
He's retelling a lot of the key stories from the Bible, and he just does like I just picked it up off the shelf just like the other day to read.
It's right here. Yeah,
a section of it to my wife because like. It's like a long story. We have some friends with kids, and they have a bunch of books that like their extended family gave them.
Yeah,
and a lot of the books have like they're like Christian like stories and messages, and we're like our kids don't know anything about those. Like, what is it? What kind of dialogue is going to open up if our kids like read a book about Noah's Ark, for example? Right. Like, we have lots of questions, and I'm like, yeah, because it's a fucked up story. Because of this Knausgård book, he writes. Like it's like a 200-page long retelling of the Noah Ark story, but from the perspective of someone who's not on the boat.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like it just goes and goes and goes, and like the water's rising, and people are climbing up the mountains, and they like the boat shows up and they're like, hey, it's the fucking God sent a boat to save us. And then like Noah pops out, he's like, no. You're not part of this. You're gonna drown. You know?
Damn.
It's really intense. And yeah, I thought that was like a beautiful part of that book. It's like he just does it for like, I don't know, three or four Bible stories, just like Cain and Abel and Noah's Ark. And like just
Eden. He's Cain and Abel.
Yeah. Yeah. You like think on it and you're like,
yeah,
what is this Bible story from any other perspective?
Right.
It's a completely insane story. You know, it has much emotional resonance to it. And it does really, really well. So yeah, you should check that out. It's a sick book.
Yeah. I got to read that one.
Yeah, so there might have been some of that going into mine because I read like a lot of him, like back when I was getting into writing again, and that book really sat with me. Yeah, it gave me nightmares about angels.
Really?
Which is crazy. It's like angels are supposed to be good, but he writes them in such this like he really writes them in this effective like these are supernatural beings and they have a logic you can't comprehend. And like how crazy and insane it would be if like an angel was actually walking around, you know, like what do they know about humans? What do they not know? How do they interact? Like it spooked me. Yeah. It's pretty good.
Yeah. I was just listening to damn Joy Williams was reading some stories of her new stories. And I think it's about like something about the soul was in the title, I think. And she was talking like one of the characters is like the devil or the fallen angel. And they're like, he's like talking to Jesus.
Oh shit. Sounds good. Yeah, I like Joy Williams a lot.
Yeah. I was going to ask, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I like her short stories a lot. And that Stories of God is really good. I haven't read all of her stuff, but I liked, how do you say that? Harrow? The green cover one with the horse on it that came out a couple of years ago?
Yeah, with the horse. Really good. Yeah. Yeah, I got to read. I read a good few from The Visiting Privilege.
Okay, I don't think I read that one. Or maybe I do. I don't know. She's got a few collections.
Yeah.
That are really good. And because, she has that quality, especially, Harrow had that quality too, because it's very, like, biblical, very apocalyptic, but it's still, like, ultimately people, you know, with their own mania and their own preoccupations.
Yeah.
And she really emphasizes, like, this disconnect between, like, parent and child, and adult and child. Like a lot of her early stories too, and like there's a lot of like little kids talking to like their drunk parents, you know, which I think is a like it's a really intense, fucked up dynamic that was and probably is pretty normal, you know. But that sucks that it's normal. Like, and that's sort of a part of the like that's a critique she's making of society or people in these stories.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you can capture a lot about the world by like writing about or thinking about relationships between adults and children, just in general, like how we think of kids. Like, do you think of a child as a person, basically? Like, is a fundamental question that people would say, like, oh, of course. But then if you like really look at their behavior or like quiz them on it, they sort of don't. You know, people have a lot of expectations on kids to behave certain ways, and they don't really think of them as just like small adults. They think of them as a different entity. I think like says a lot about how we think about each other.
Damn.
So yeah, that's probably why I was writing about kids stuff a lot too in the book, because it's like it changes how you think about the world. Obviously, in the future, in like the present, and what normal means, because like your kids are going to think whatever is around them is normal.
Yeah.
So it's like up to you to try to make it good. You want that normal to be good.
Yeah. Yeah. You feel like you got to try to make it good if you have a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but then you're an adult. Like, you know, I have all these visceral memories of like, cause my first kid didn't sleep well for like a really long time. It still doesn't sleep that well. And so like, especially right when the lockdowns are starting, and you know, I'd just be up all night with my kid, like in a rocking chair, just like looking at my phone, reading about like the death tolls and like, oh, they found a new case like in the next town over and all this stuff. And like, they're locking stuff down. It's like a fucked up time to be like with a baby.
For
real. and then to see, yeah, like you're talking about like the eternal and like,
yeah.
So it was like, the institutions around us felt like they were falling apart.
That's what I'm saying. You know, yeah.
Like the government didn't seem stable.
Right. And the idea of the state even is being a sense of belonging.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Like you take for granted all these institutions
right.
to like the name normal.
Right.
And like business to behave a certain way, and presidents to behave a certain way, and
right.
people to behave a certain way. And then like this big disruption happened, and you realize right. like none of it, yeah, it could fall apart at any time. It kind of is. It's kind of like actively falling apart. You know, things kind of like stabilized and things are sort of normal now. But like, yeah, especially at the time, it felt super tumultuous. And it was, like I said, like you just look at people differently. But then it's also like, that's normal. You wake up every day and you have to do it. Whatever it is, you're still doing it.
do you feel like, what are the main things that keep you optimistic? This is Zach trying to be like, everything's fucked, bro.
Yeah.
And then me being like, you don't gotta end it absurdly, dude. Like you could have earnest optimism about something, and you're like, fuck you, bro.
I mean think like all of it. I think it's fine. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Like
everything's fine, bro.
Yeah. I mean, again, like just from the context of kids, like my kids are great.